Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Hello, friends. You're listening to episode number 5 of the Fergan podcast. Before we begin, I just want to extend a huge thank you to everyone who has supported this endeavour so far. So whether you've shared the podcast links around or recommended it to people, or perhaps even supported financially, all of it helps and all of it is much appreciated. So thank you. So I hope you enjoyed the last episode where I did a kind of deep dive on the Northmen and my thoughts on it. With this episode, I'm going to talk about the supernatural. So one significant aspect of any spiritual tradition is the idea that there is more to existence than meets the eye. That we are not just flesh and bones. That the material is not the be-all and end-all of existence. When I did the first two episodes, Why Paganism and How to Practice Paganism, part of the motivation in those was to speak to those who are perhaps either Christian or interested in Christianity and hadn't considered that there's a more natural path for them to take in paganism or heathenry. But this episode that I'm recording now, episode number 5, I think will probably be of interest particularly to those who are more atheistic. So those who are skeptical of religion completely, whether it be the Abrahamic religions or paganism or another tradition. Because this is something that I struggled with myself. You know, as I mentioned in the first episode, I was christened but raised in an atheist family. When I reached my teenage years, well, in my younger years, I kind of held on to this idea that I was a Christian, but that was purely because I was very close friends with my cousin whose family was Christian and who I was christened alongside. So he and I had this kind of brotherhood in our, you know, our christened status. But when I reached my teenage years, I turned to atheism, as most people of my generation did, really. I've got a very empirical mind. And I want you to remember that as you listen to this episode, because although I'm not going to expect you to take my anecdotes, my observations and my experiences at you know, at face value, I'm not going to expect you to, you know, trust wholly in what I'm telling you. Because that's something that I have great difficulty doing when someone tells me stories which seem kind of far flung. I can't help but receive them with a you know, an amount of skepticism or even cynicism. And I wouldn't blame anyone for doing the same when they hear what I've got to say in this episode. I actually, after the experiences, I'm gonna detail three experiences that I've had in my life, and probably the three most significant experiences, and they're all different. They're kind of, you know, I kind of dislike the word supernatural because it kind of suggests that natural isn't good enough. You know, that what we can't see with our material senses is somehow not part of nature. You know, it's beyond nature, and that's not true. I consider the experiences that I've had and the experiences that many people report, such as seeing apparitions and things like that, I consider them very much natural, not beyond natural. But nevertheless, these are things which are not usually experienced in our material realm, in our natural material realm. So for the sake of clarity, I'll just continue to use the word supernatural. And I think, these experiences were very important to me because they kicked me out of my overly kind of empirical, calculating, skeptical mindset. You know, I wanted to, from a cultural and fascination perspective, I wanted to believe in, let me rephrase that. I was already very interested in spiritual traditions from a cultural perspective, but I had difficulty accepting that these, you know, the kind of the theology that surrounds them, the cosmology that's part of these traditions, has any worth to those who haven't experienced anything supernatural. I didn't ask to experience the things that I've experienced, and it's difficult to imagine what my mindset would be if I hadn't. So it's probably best if I just go through the three stories that I want to tell you. And some of you will have heard one, maybe two of these stories because I've done brief voice recordings on the Telegram channel about them. But many of you won't have heard these before. So I'll go through them in chronological order. The first one, I was living with my parents and I was I'd been with my wife, who was then my girlfriend, for perhaps just a year or so, not very long. So her and I, we would see each other once a week at the time. She was living and studying in London and I lived just outside of London, just west of London. And one Saturday night, I was on my own and I went to bed, you know, as normal, nothing unusual about the evening. Went to bed alone and I woke up to the experience of my bed shaking, just very gently rocking. Well, not very gently, kind of moderately rocking. As soon as I opened my eyes, I saw a dark shadow above me, just briefly, just for a split second, and then it disappeared. But I sat up, I turned my bedside light on, and the bed still continued to shake just for a few seconds. And it was a very, very strange experience. It was, you know, the fact that I'd sat up and turned my light on, I wasn't still dreaming I don't believe I was. So the next morning I got up and I was convinced that there must have been some kind of small earthquake somewhere not too far away that I'd felt the tremors of, or something else had happened. And you know, this kind of speaks to how empirical my mindset was at the time. You know, I could not accept that it was anything supernatural. There had to have been a scientific explanation for it. So I searched, I went online first thing in the morning. I, you know, searched, you know, Googled, you know, for earthquakes or other occurrences that had happened. And there was nothing, absolutely nothing whatsoever. I sort of, okay, all right. Well, I thought, well, okay, so maybe I was dreaming then. Maybe I imagined it, you know, didn't kind of think too much of it. I think I spoke to my wife, my girlfriend at the time, and she said, oh, that's a, you know, strange thing you've experienced there, but, you know, what could it be? You know, we'll never know. So life went on for the following week, and the next weekend, my wife came to stay. So she came to stay at my parents' house on the Saturday, and we woke up early in the morning to the sensation of a shaking bed. So my wife was obviously perplexed because I told her what happened the previous Saturday night or early Sunday morning. And this was not quite the same time. It was a little bit later in the morning, you know, about 6 a.m. in the morning. And we woke up to the feeling of the bed shaking. And, you know, I think I don't remember whether we managed to get back to sleep or what. But it was, it blew our minds, you know, needless to say, because of what I'd experienced, you know, almost exactly 7 days before. So we got up the next day and we found out that there had been a explosion at a place called Buntsfield Fuel Depot in Hemel Hempstead, which was, you know, this, I was living, my parents' house was in on the Buckinghamshire-Berkshire border. So Hemel Hempstead is, that's Hertfordshire, I believe, which is, I don't know, something like an hour's drive roughly north, sort of northeast of where I was living. But this explosion had been so huge that it had sent shockwaves across, you know, most of southern England, and such shockwaves that it had shook my bed and probably everyone else's bed. This explosion happened on the 11th of December 2005 at 6 a.m. in the morning. So, to me, the fact that I had almost exactly a week earlier woken to the kind of almost like a premonition of this explosion that had occurred a week later, there was no coincidence in that. You know, that to me was a clear sign that there is something else at play in our lives, whether there was some kind of for some reason, whether there was some kind of energy or force trying to warn me of what would happen a week later, or if it was just, you know, like a glitch in the matrix, as they say. Either way, I even with my empirical mind, I couldn't put it down to coincidence. So that was the first, what I would consider truly paranormal, supernatural experience that I had in my life, which I couldn't explain away by scientific material means. The next experience was some years later. I guess it would probably have been around 2012, something like that. Yeah, I'd say 2012. I had recently become active with a heathen group, and I met up with a couple of the guys from the group. It was kind of an unofficial meetup, and we met up near Wayland Smithy. In the corner of Oxfordshire. So I think we met up at a pub, and then there were four of us. One of the guys had his son with him and a dog. We met up at a pub on a Saturday summer afternoon. Had a drink and then walked up to the Uffington White Horse and had a wander around at the Uffington Castle, which is an old like Iron Age hill fort just above the Uffington White Horse. And from there, we walked over to Wayland Smithy, which is, you know, quite a trek. I think it's about a 45-minute walk from there along the Ridgeway. And we sort of spent the evening at the Smithy, at Wayland Smithy. Now, I'll describe what Wayland Smithy is like. Wayland Smithy is a Neolithic burial mound, a long barrow. It was reconstructed, I think, in the Victorian era to try and be somewhat faithful to its original form. It is set within a kind of, you know, roughly square or rectangular enclosure just off of the ridgeway. The enclosure is kind of just lined with trees. You know, I think they're either oak or beech trees. When you exit the ridgeway, you go through a metal gate. You walk kind of, I don't know, 100 yards or so along a narrow path, perpendicular to the ridgeway. And then you enter the Wayland Smithy enclosure through another metal gate. And it's a wonderful place. It's great. It's, you know, it's quite well visited because it's a really great example of a Neolithic barrow. And it's somewhere that I've always been drawn to. I've been there many, many times. I've been there a couple of times before, and I've been there many times since. And these three friends, who unfortunately I've lost contact with, but at the time we were quite good friends, and we made a little fire just in front of the smithy on a Saturday evening, and we stood around and we just chatted with one another, and we performed a couple of rites. I think it was probably around maybe half nine in the evening. We stood around the fire and we performed a rite to honour both Wayland and Woden. It was quite a brief but, you know, heartfelt, sincere rite, as they always should be. And, we finished, you know, honouring both of those gods. And then we turned back to the fire, stood in a small circle. And within no more than half an hour later, we had a very strange experience. It sends chills down my spine to just, you know, to retell the story. But we stood around a fire. We, as I say, there was a child with us and a dog. I think it was a Cocker Spaniel. So quite a lively, alert dog. And then we suddenly realised that, you know, perhaps 15 to 20 yards away from us, there was a figure who walked straight over towards us. And he was an old man. He was a tall, slender old man in a long black coat, and he walked straight over to us and, you know, said hello. And then he said, one of the first things he said to us was, "You're here for Wayland, aren't you?" And we sort of looked at each other and politely said to him, "Well, yeah, we are, you know." And I mean, that's nothing strange about that. It's Wayland Smithy. Why wouldn't we be there for Wayland? But he seemed to know that we were honouring Wayland, which is not something which is commonly done by visitors to Wayland Smithy. You know, it's generally taken as a historical curiosity rather than anything of religious significance, because of, you know, so few people who go there have anything resembling a pagan worldview. That they know of anyway. So this guy said, he was completely unafraid. He had no inhibitions about approaching four men stood around a small fire on a Saturday evening. And I've got some notes about this occurrence, which I've not actually brought up. So I'm going to try and tell the story completely from memory. There are quite a few details, so I hope I don't leave any out. But the first thing to note is that nobody ever leaves the ridgeway and approach and goes through these two metal gates to get to Wayland Smithy without making a clanging noise. You always invariably you can hear people approaching because of the gates. You know, these are typical kind of gates with a spring. You push them shut. They clang loudly as these, you know, rural, you know, gates do. There was none of that. We hadn't heard a thing when this man approached. Not a thing. He'd been quiet as a mouse. And as I say, the dog hadn't noted anything. And the dog became quite nervous when the man got near. The other thing was, he had no torch whatsoever. He was using a walking stick, a cane, and he was walking, with a limp, very, very laboured. And he said to us, he said, "I was just on my way back from a party, and I thought I'd stop to pay my respects." Now, Wayland Smithy is not on the way to or from anywhere. It's very rural around there. There are some small hamlets nearby, perhaps, you know, a 5-minute drive in either direction. But Wayland Smithy itself is a long distance from any roads. There's a lane that turns off. I can't remember what the B road is, but there's a lane that turns off of that goes up the hill towards the Smith, towards the Ridgeway. But you have to leave your car and then walk quite a long way along the Ridgeway to reach the smithy. It's a very strange place to stop off on the way anywhere, especially for an elderly man late on a Saturday night with no torch, and a walking stick along quite a bumpy path. The Ridgeway is quite bumpy. It's not really suitable for elderly men with canes to walk upon. So we found that very strange. And by the way, most of the kind of strangeness of this experience only really hit us afterwards when we discussed it between ourselves. So this man, who I distinctly remember looking very similar to the actor Charles Dance, which some of you may know from, if you've seen Game of Thrones. I forget the character's name, but he was in the first couple of seasons as the, the king of, I forget which region of the world. But anyway, if you look up Game of Thrones Charles Dance, you'll see a picture of him. This man looked quite like him. He was dressed very dapper. He was wearing a waistcoat, like a black waistcoat with a tie, and as I say, a long black coat. I think he was wearing glasses. I can't quite remember. I don't believe he had any headwear on. But he spoke to us for a few minutes, and he told us that he likes to come up to Wayland Smithy on his birthday with all of his children and all of his grandchildren, and they have a picnic there. And he said that he'd been coming up there for years and years, and he always liked to pay his respects to Wayland. If I remember rightly, all four of us who he had approached were quite kind of speechless at the situation. We were dumbfounded, to be honest, and didn't quite know how to take this man. We didn't, you know, was he a bit, was he a bit insane? Did he have all of his marbles? Was he being judgmental? Was he being completely friendly? It wasn't quite clear what his intention was. I do remember him staring quite intently, certainly at me and at the others, I'm sure, as well. I think he was a man who was unafraid to make eye contact for long periods of time. And he was not afraid of us, not in any way afraid. I mean, imagine as an elderly man, approaching four guys on a Saturday night in the dark at a completely isolated, strange historic site such as Wayland Smithy, and just approaching them, walking straight up to them without a torch, without forewarning, without anything. He was a confident man for sure. He then, you know, bade us a good night, and he then hobbled over to the front facing stones of Wayland Smithy, and he took his walking stick, and he stood there for about a minute or so, and he tapped on one of the huge stones of the smithy in a kind of almost like a, the best way I can describe it is like Morse code. And he tapped away on the stone in a quite deliberate but strange rhythm. He didn't say a word. We, you know, the four of us, my three friends and I, we stood there kind of not speaking, kind of, you know, giving each other, you know, the eye, saying, as if to say, what the hell is this guy about? And, you know, we let him do his thing without interrupting. And he finished making his strange, his strange communication to his old friend Wayland. That was the other thing as well. But before he went and made these tapping rhythms on the stone, he said to us that he used to make rings like Wayland. He used to make rings like Wayland. Now, many of you will know that Wayland is like a Germania wide. You know, figure from our lore, a blacksmith, a famous blacksmith, you know, the most skilled of blacksmiths. And this guy who'd approached us said that he used to make rings like Wayland. Now, those of you who are more familiar with my musical project Walkensman will know that I've got a song called Rings Like Wayland, which was on, I can't remember which compilation, but it was contributed to a compilation album. I think it was, there was an old online, like a journal called Heathen Harvest, which I wrote for at the time. And I was asked to contribute an exclusive song to that. So I wrote and recorded an instrumental song called Rings Like Wayland, which was named after the experience that I'd had. So, anyway, this guy, he finishes his little ritual, and then he walks back past us to exit the enclosure. And we said to him, do you want some help getting back to the Ridgeway? Do you want a torch? Do you want one of us to come with you? And he said, oh, no, don't worry. And off he went in the dark, in the pitch dark, with a walking stick, an elderly man, at about 10 p.m. on a Saturday night, to walk for probably, at least 15, 20 minutes. And that's best case scenario if he'd driven to the closest point he could have done, which not many people know that you can do. I mean, this guy presumably would have known that. So, but still, very strange thing. My three friends and I, we had a kind of private web forum that we frequented. And in the days and weeks following that experience, we continued to kind of discuss it and come back to it. And all of us, independently and collectively, reached the conclusion that it was not merely a mortal man that we'd encountered that evening. Now, I know this is gonna seem ridiculous to some of you. I know that, particularly if you are listening to this podcast out of a more detached curiosity to the pagan or spiritual ways. If you're a follower of Christianity or any of the Abrahamic or other existing religions, then you would presumably be more open-minded to what I'm saying. You would probably believe that I had encountered a demon that evening, or you may even say that it was Christ in some kind of disguise, something like that. But you should, if you're really a religious person, you should be able to consider the possibility that it was something more than material normality. If you are an atheist or an agnostic, then you probably think I'm a bit mad right now. But frankly, that doesn't bother me. I'm not, you know, I've held on to this story for long enough now that I'm unashamed to declare my belief that what I experienced that night was Woden. Now, the reason that I'm confident about that is because we were four Wodenists who had specifically journeyed to meet together at a site sacred to Wayland, and we believe by extension sacred to Woden as well, as he is the Allfather. And this is another thing, you know, this man had said that he spent his birthdays there with all of his children and all of his grandchildren, and to me that was a hint, that was a clue he was giving us there, that he was the Allfather. So we convened at this sacred site, and we performed a rite to honour both Wayland and Woden. And then within half an hour, at the most unusual, unassuming of times imaginable, you know, late on a dark Saturday evening, when no one visits the smithy, this man, within half an hour of us honouring Woden and Wayland, this tall man in black clothing and a long black coat with a walking stick turns up. He knows why we're there. He declares that he is also there to honour Wayland. He stares, as far as I'm concerned, stared into my very soul. It felt like a sort of judgment, to be honest. And some of you might say that that's a very Judeo-Christian mindset to have, that you are being judged by your gods. But I believe that all of us, our worth is being judged all the time, and not by a single god, not just by Woden, not just by any other deities, but by ourselves, by our ancestors, by our higher self, and by our gods, yes. And it's more kind of like a loving kind of check to say, you know, are you on the right path? You know, what are you doing with your life? You know, it was almost like a look, as if to say, I like the fact that you're here. I know why you're here. I like the fact that you're here. And I want you to go away from this knowing that something special happened this evening. And I want you to take that knowledge and do good things with it. There's also an inexplicable X factor to it. Sometimes you can't appraise these things analytically. You can't calculate a religious or spiritual experience. And those experiences are perhaps meant for only the person experiencing them to know what they were really about. So in a sense, there's probably little use me even relaying this story to you, other than the fact that you might be curious about it. I'm not expecting any of you to take what I'm saying at face value and to trust that, yes, Dan did indeed meet Woden, manifest in human form that evening. But I'm telling the story because I believe that I did. And not only that, but I believe that it was a formative experience in my spiritual journey. And when I have got through telling the next, the third of my experiences, I'll explain that aspect of it a bit, the power of these experiences in my life. Also, I forgot to mention at the beginning, you know, it might seem a little bit self-indulgent, me kind of sitting here expecting you to listen to my experiences as though my experiences are more important than anyone else's. And that's, I don't mean it to come across that way. I wasn't able to arrange having a guest to speak with on this episode of the podcast, as well as the fact that these are quite personal experiences to me, and there'd be little point me bringing anyone else on to talk about them unless it was someone who had experienced them as well. I'm telling these stories because I want people to know that even with the most analytical, empirical of minds, which I possess, you know, I've always considered myself quite left-brained, quite strongly left-brained. I think I've come to realize in the following years that I'm actually not as left-brained as I always assumed I was. But at the time of these experiences, I certainly did believe that I was quite a left-brained person, quite a scientific, methodical, thinking man, rather than, you know, I was Hugin rather than Moonen. He who thinks rather than he who remembers. So the third story that I'd like to relay, and you'll hopefully see why these are three quite different supernatural experiences. You know, the first one was kind of like a premonition, arguably involving an apparition. The second experience was a divine encounter with divinity, with a deity, in human form, you know, in apparently material human form. I mean, the man that who approached us, none of us shook his hand, but I'm sure that we could have done. I'm sure that it wasn't some kind of phantom. The third experience was a dream that I had. I'm not someone who regularly remembers my dreams. I don't know about any of you listening. Some of you may regularly remember dreams. Some of you may not. I don't tend to usually. Although I do think in the last couple of years, I feel like I've started to wake up remembering more of my dreams. But in my entire life, I've had a handful of what I would consider to be very vivid dreams. And this is one of them, perhaps the most vivid that I've ever had. I have actually brought up some brief notes that I had on this, which I shared on a forum at the time with some trusted friends. So this dream occurred in April 2013. And I'll just read this out to you so that I, you know, don't forget any details. I had a dream last night, which was quite different to most of my mundane dreams. I only remember a fraction of it, but I think there's enough to draw on. For some reason, I was on a long, epic quest, alone in an icy landscape. Think The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I was looking for something, but I don't remember what. Finally, after a long hike, I came to a pond with two giant white swans sat in it. They were calm, but their beaks had been gummed shut by ice or something. They communicated to me that they needed help. I had, telepathically that is, I had something with me which freed their beaks, I can't remember what it was, and then turned and hiked back to my point of origin. So that was the first dream that I had. I actually then, after speaking with some friends, I attempted to return to that same, you know, I hesitate to use this, but the same imaginary landscape by meditating. When I did, I had another experience, which I will just relay to you now. I visited the two giant swans again in their pond, though this time it was warm and sunny. Initially they pecked at me, but I stepped backwards and then they calmly showed me images to answer my questions. First they communicated the word guardian to me, and then I was shown a line being drawn into sand and then a trickle of water running down it and dispersing into the sand. Then I was shown a black sky with a bolt of lightning or a sudden congregation of stars across it. With this second journey, I had sought out these same entities that I'd experienced in my dreams. And the two experiences together, the dream and the meditation, kind of form a whole. Firstly, I will mention that, again, anyone familiar with my Project Walkensman will know that I wrote a song for my second album called The Swans of Gar's Edge, which is about this dream, which is about this experience. And actually, the whole of my short story, The Fire in the White Stone, includes this scene within it, because I came to believe that the dream was given to me for a specific reason, and I spent a long time meditating upon that dream and trying to work out what message was being conveyed to me, what symbols I was meant to be grasping from it. And I now believe, first and foremost, that the swans, or certainly at least one of the swans, represented an aspect of my higher self. And by ungumming the beak of the swan, which was gummed shut by ice, I was enabling it to speak freely or sing. Now, 2013 was also the year when I began Walkensman, my musical project, which is kind of my main creative child, my musical kind of passion, really. When I started Walkensman, I was only a guitarist. I'd never sung before, but I couldn't find anyone who was passionate enough about that type of music to do the vocals for me. So I just kind of, you know, bit the bullet and had a go at doing it myself. And, you know, the early attempts at singing are kind of, they're okay, but they're a bit rough around the edges, let's say. But I stuck with it and got to a point now, 9 years later, where I consider myself a pretty good singer. And not only that, but I've also become very vocal about my beliefs, about my convictions, which I had held since before this dream that occurred. You know, the worldview that I hold now is the same that I've broadly held since the mid-2000s, at least, certainly. Obviously, I've honed my beliefs along the way. I've learnt a lot. I've, you know, improved my understanding of things. But I have, I've held the same beliefs for pretty much that whole time. But for a large part of it, I've kept those beliefs pretty close to my chest. And many of you will sympathise with that. You'll know why, because the beliefs that many of us hold, and they're not, you know, obviously they're not based on hatred whatsoever. They're based on a love of our own, folk and our own culture, and a desire to preserve what was handed down to us by our ancestors. But also a love of global diversity. I mean, I've always been a staunch fighter for global diversity. I don't want to see any of the world's ethnic groups disappear into this kind of Western black hole that my own culture seems to be circling, and has been for several, well, certainly several decades at the very least. But nevertheless, it's not easy to publicly hold those beliefs. But over the last few years, and certainly over the last 2 years, I've become completely open about everything that I believe, and there really isn't anything that I hide from anyone. When I had this dream and I ungummed the beaks of these swans, I believe that I was symbolically freeing my own ability to speak freely, as well as setting Walkensman on a, perhaps conceiving of Walkensman, because as far as I can remember, this dream occurred before I formally began the Walkensman project, which started, you know, I had ideas, but I believe I recorded the demo, you know, later on in 2013. So to me, it's not a coincidence that I had this dream and then set my voice free in certainly two tangible ways, in singing and in speaking freely about my beliefs and convictions. I also believe, you know, not to go too much into it, I may do another show on this, another episode on this, but the swan is connected with the Algitzrun, known in, I believe, Germany as the Alkis or Alsis. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. The Algitzrun, if you look at the form of it, it looks like a swan rear, you know, with its wings raised in the way that swans often do, particularly when they're in kind of action mode. The Alkis are also twins, also represents the concept of twinship, and there were two swans. These were all these symbolic aspects, these runic elements to what I experienced, are not things that I was aware of when I had this dream. And it was only afterwards, in meditating on it and researching and speaking to other people who were more knowledgeable than me, that I came to realize how archaic the symbolism of that dream was, and how congruent it was with our ancient Indo-European lore. The swan is also certainly in Germanic and Celtic lore, it's a sacred animal, connected with the Valkyries, so therefore connected with the connection between life and death. The whiteness of the swan represents purity in the same way as the whiteness of a horse or the whiteness of a dragon. They're essentially symbolizing the same things. There's a lot more I could go into on this, but as I say, I may do another episode on this. So these three experiences that I had are three of the most profound experiences I've had in my life, and I can't, with any good conscience, put them down to coincidence. Some of you may still, you know, want to kind of grab me by the shoulders and shake me and say, Dan, they were coincidence. But you and I share a different worldview, clearly. And all due respect, I don't agree with you. I analyze these events from an empirical point of view. Certainly the first two of the stories that I've told, I didn't want to believe or accept that they were in any way supernatural. But to this day, I can't deny it, and I refuse to deny it. And actually, I believe that it would be an insult now for me to deny those things, because I believe that I was visited or sent messages by higher forces. I believe that I did encounter Woden. I had the incredible honor of being approached by Woden, who I have always, and especially since then, felt a very strong bond with. Woden, for those of you who don't know, is known in the lore. He is. It's told in the Icelandic sagas that Woden walks among men, particularly Woden among the gods, walks among men at times. It is said, yes, that he wears a wide-brimmed hat and has one eye and wears a long black cloak. The man or god who I encountered didn't have a wide-brimmed hat, and he didn't he seemed to have two working eyes. But I don't believe that that detail diminishes the truth of the matter, which is that it was Woden. If you think about it, in the times of the Icelandic Vikings, if a god were to manifest in Midgard and walk among men, it wouldn't have been seen as a strange occurrence. It would not have shocked the people of the time, because it was their tradition that this happened. It was not even considered for a moment to be something, you know, disbelievable. It was something that happened from time to time. In our modern age, few of us have the psychological capacity to accept such a thing. And I think that if Woden had appeared to me with a wide-brimmed hat and one eye, it would have been too obvious. And for whatever reason, related to that encounter, he didn't want myself and my three friends to know instantly who he was. It was something that had to kind of stew in our minds in the days and weeks and months and years following it. So there was a tactfulness about the way that he presented himself. That's what I believe, anyway. And obviously, you know, when I look back upon my personal weird, and I look at how I got to where I am now, where I am making these podcasts, and I'm sharing my experiences of heathenry with people, and I'm being candidly open about my beliefs and convictions with regards to what's going on in the world. How did I get to this point? When I look back, it couldn't have happened without the experiences that I had. Walkensman has been a major factor in it, because Walkensman is a project which has given me confidence as a solo venturer. It's the first time I've ever gone out and done something, a band or a musical project on my own. And it has been my thing since the beginning for the last 9 years. And I went out on a limb when I did it. I didn't expect to make more than a demo. But my decision to, you know, to set off down the path of Walkensman, I believe, was precipitated by the dream I had where I encountered these swans. And in analysing that dream, I came to realise that Walkensman was supposed to be my opportunity to open my mouth and speak freely and to sing freely. And that directly leads to the point where I am today, where I am speaking freely and I am singing. And I've been asked to contribute vocals to other projects as guest vocals, some of which are, you know, to come out in the next year or so. I've been asked to join a band as lead vocalist, a band who I am a big fan of. So there'll be more singing in my future, and as long as the podcast continues to go well, there'll be more outspokenness. Meeting Woden, as I believe I did, that incident gave me enormous confidence in my heathen path, that heathenry is the legitimate natural spiritual path for not just myself, but all people of English, Germanic, or even wider European ancestry. Incidentally, I had my genealogy done, and like most people, my ancestry connects back through King Alfred, back through the Normans after him, and back to Woden via both King Alfred and through the Norman royalty and through the Viking lords to Odin. Obviously, Woden under a you know, essentially similar name. So, encountering Woden, as I entirely believe I did, it has given me the confidence to pursue this path with boldness and with no fear of kind of humiliation or anything. I don't care about that. I don't care what people want to think of me. And I think one of the most important things that you, if you are an aspiring pagan, one of the things that you can, probably the most important thing you can learn to do is to just have faith in yourself and your ancestors and your gods and your traditions. Don't worry about what people think. Most people don't understand paganism, and they think it's ridiculous, or they've just seen Wicca as presented in, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer or some bullshit like that. Most people don't understand it, and what people don't understand, they mock. That speaks more about their insecurities than it does about you. So get rid of the inhibition that you have about being openly pagan, about pursuing this path. Perhaps you'll be as blessed as I have been, and you will have similar encounters which only strengthen your resolve, which make you even more confident that you are on the right path. And with that, I'll close off this episode. And if anyone's got any comments or questions about the stories that I've relayed here, please feel free to contact me. You know, leave a comment in under the Telegram posts or in the Telegram Fergen chat, or visit fergen.com, fyrgen.com, and there's a contact form on there where you can message me. Alternatively, you could just directly email me at fergen@protonmail.com. And whilst I may not have time to, you know, exchange essay length emails with all of you, I certainly will reply to all of you, and I'll do my very best to answer any questions that you might have about this podcast or any other episodes. But yeah, that said, I'll now move on to the riddle section of the show, which hopefully some of you are still enjoying. So in the last episode, number 4 of the Fergen, I read a riddle, the answer to which is a millstone, a flail, or a lock. Millstone, flail, and lock have their advocates, but bell is the most favoured solution to this riddle. Of course it is. That might seem too obvious to some of you. I mean, if I go back to the riddle, it has a line: a warm limb releases the bound ring, you know, but it delights my thane, a dull sort. So there are some quite strong hints there of it being a bell. I'm sure some of you got that. So riddle number 5 for episode number 5. I'm by nature solitary, scarred by spear and wounded by sword, weary of battle. I frequently see the face of war and fight hateful enemies, yet I hold no hope of help being brought to me in the battle. Before I'm eventually done to death, in the stronghold of the city, sharp-edged swords, skillfully forged in the flame by smiths, bite deeply into me. I can but await a more fearsome encounter. It is not for me to discover in the city any of those doctors who heal grievous wounds with roots and herbs. The scars from sword wounds gape wider and wider. Death blows are dealt me by day and by night. There we go. And I have to say, that's of the riddles that I've read, I've not actually read the whole book fully through, but that's one of my favourites so far. So I hope you enjoyed that. And I hope you enjoyed the episode as a whole. And I thank you very much for your attention and for listening. And again, if you feel that you know anyone who might find this interesting or any of the other episodes, please share the links with them. Recommend it. The podcast is now available on Spotify, on Apple Music. It's available to supporters a week early on Patreon, Subscribestar, and Substack. And then a week later, it's freely available on Telegram and Odyssey, as well as on the aforementioned Spotify and Apple Music. So supporters get the episodes a week early. And if you are able to spare anything, then obviously it's much appreciated, because time goes into these, into the recording, into the editing, creating the graphics, you know, writing the descriptions and promoting them. And future episodes will, you know, lots of the episodes that I'll be doing will have dedicated research gone into them, as well as guests who are knowledgeable about certain subjects. So I'm really doing my best here to create a quality podcast, and I hope you agree. So anyway, until next time, be well.